Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, with a margin of 410-8, the House of Representatives passed a resolution endorsing Israel's attacks on Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. But our guest explains that that overwhelming bipartisan majority endorsed some other things as well, including the meaninglessness of international law and potential military action against Iran and Syria. Professor Stephen Zunis will join us to discuss that. Also on the show, in media circles, buzzwords like values are usually defined in a way that favors conservatives. UC Berkeley linguist Jeff Nunberg explains in his new book, Talking Right, that that's no accident, but part of a concerted effort by the right to define the language of politics. He'll join us to talk about the role media play. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
In the current round of Israeli attacks on Gaza and Lebanon, there are plenty of issues that go unexamined. One defense of Israeli military tactics you hear often in the media is that they're not targeting civilians. As proof of this, they often call those civilians ahead of time and tell them they're going to be bombed. The Los Angeles Times reviewed this tactic on August 1st under the headline, Israel Warns Gazans Panic. Readers might have been left with the impression that while it's bad to see your house or your neighborhood blown up, the advance warning is appreciated. But the report didn't have room to mention an obvious point, that such warnings do not absolve Israel of its legal obligation to avoid attacking civilians. As the International Red Cross put it in their statement, quote, issuing advance warning to the civilian population of impending attacks in no way relieves a warring party of its obligations under the rules and principles of international humanitarian law, close quote. The Times does, however, have the space to mention that Israeli officials suggest that after being warned, quote, those who remain behind are responsible for their own fate, close quote. The Times also recalls several times when warnings were issued but bombs didn't fall, which, according to Human Rights Watch, also violates international law. The paper did note that despite the warnings being issued in Gaza, quote, the practice has not won over many hearts or minds, close quote.
When it comes to the Israeli attack on Lebanon, U.S. media consumers may be intimately aware of Hezbollah's weapons and their suppliers. Hezbollah's ball-bearing packed rockets, for example, have received extensive coverage on CNN, NBC, and in the Washington Post. But when a July 24th Human Rights Watch report accused Israel of using cluster bombs in civilian areas of Lebanon, which could be a violation of international law, most U.S. media outlets ignored it. The LA Times buried the news at the end of a July 25th report, and on July 27th, the New York Times described Israel's use of such weapons merely as another matter that has drawn criticism. Up to this point, such weapons had not been mentioned in the paper of record, except for one reference to Hezbollah's alleged use of them. Cluster bombs, which can spread hundreds of bomblets that become dangerous landmines, are not the only weapons in the Israeli arsenal raising questions. They've also been accused of illegally using white phosphorus, a napalm-like incendiary, against Lebanese civilians. But again, media attention has been sparse. In one CNN report, a U.S. military analyst declared that, although he had no knowledge of Israel's use of white phosphorus, he could nonetheless deny that they could possibly be using it. CNN host Anderson Cooper chimed in to reiterate the Israeli position that Hezbollah takes up positions in residential neighborhoods, quote, and that's why we're seeing the civilian damage to the extent that we have, close quote.
The August 8th Democratic primary in Connecticut will pit pro-war incumbent Senator Joe Lieberman against anti-war insurgent Ned Lamont. With the latest polls showing Lamont in the lead, the media establishment is weighing in, predictably on Lieberman's side. In a July 30th column, Washington Post columnist David Broder warned Lamont backers that, quote, their breed of Democrats, many of them wealthy, educated, extremely liberal, often pick candidates who are rejected by the broader public, close quote. Anticipating a Lieberman defeat, Broder predicted that the results of the primary will point Democrats across the nation, quote, leftward toward a stronger anti-war stand. But often in the past, the early successes of these elitist insurgents have been followed by decisive defeats when a broader public weighs in, close quote. Well, you'd never guess from columns like Broder's that a stronger anti-war stance is actually quite popular. In the latest CBS New York Times poll, 63% said the war wasn't worth the cost. Only 30% said it was. It's funny how a shift to the majority position can be maligned as elitist and leftward. Apparently, it's only a move toward the much-vaunted center when it's a move to the right. Like Broder, Newsweek's Jonathan Alter told Democrats they had to support Lieberman, a warning particularly directed at the bloggers who have, quote-unquote, noisily intervened in the Connecticut primary. It's not clear why bloggers make more noise when they give their opinions than do columnists for Newsweek. But Alter's really irritated by what he calls the bloggers' quest for ideological purity. What that seems to amount to is that anti-war Democrats actually oppose the war and genuinely don't want to see their own party waging it. For pundits like Broder and Alter, such a view puts you beyond the pale.
Regular readers of mainstream economic reporting know that there are some ideas that in the real world are highly and even hotly contested, but in elite media's coverage are placed beyond challenge or even argument. Support for so-called free trade that puts the interests of big corporations first and sidelines labor, environmental, and human rights is one such idea. Oh, you can raise questions about it in the major media. You just can't be taken seriously if you do so, whereas endorsing such policies requires no explanation or evidence. A recent front-page story from the New York Times' business section, pointed out by the nation's Eric Alterman, makes a good example. Addressing the failure of recent global trade discussions, The Times says, quote, "But the collapse of world trade talks this week has again proved that a small number of farmers in the United States, as well as Europe, Japan, India, and other trading partners, have the power to resist lower agricultural tariffs and subsidies, even though a global trade deal might ultimately benefit most of them," close quote. As Alterman notes, the reporters feel no need to provide any evidence whatsoever that a global trade deal might benefit most of these farmers. Readers are encouraged to assume comfortably that the farmers are simply ignorant of their own best interests, perhaps because they don't read The Times. Lest we be accused of putting media's acceptance and promotion of this particular economic gospel too crudely, listen to The Times' own Thomas Friedman, preeminent in his preaching of the free trade line. On CNBC's Tim Russert program recently, Friedman mentioned that he had been asked if there was any free trade agreement he would oppose. In Friedman's words, quote, "I said, no, absolutely not. I said, you know what, sir? I wrote a column supporting the CAFTA, the Caribbean Free Trade Initiative. I didn't even know what was in it. I just knew two words, free trade," close quote. As David Sirota pointed out in a column he wrote for the Huffington Post, Russert didn't even see fit to pose a follow-up question in response to the admission by a major media figure that he has no problem using his influential position to promote policies that he doesn't bother to actually read or learn about. He doesn't even know that CAFTA stood for Central American Free Trade Agreement, not Caribbean. Nevertheless, New York Times readers are instructed day after day to take seriously Friedman's ideas on trade policy, while the views of those farmers, we're told, can be dismissed without a thought.
And finally, partisan divide on Iraq exceeds split on Vietnam, read the New York Times headline on July 30th. Under that banner were the results of a new poll that shows people who identify themselves as either Republicans or Democrats are miles apart when it comes to the Iraq War. Well, that's interesting, of course, but not all that surprising. More interesting was when the Times tried to explain why this was so newsworthy. Quote, "These divisions do not run across foreign policy. The latest poll shows no comparable partisan gap, for example, in attitudes toward the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon," close quote. The Times goes on to note as evidence that the congressional resolution supporting Israel passed overwhelmingly with the support of politicians from both parties. But public opinion is very different than official political opinion. While Congress members may have voted overwhelmingly to support the Israeli attacks on Lebanon and Gaza, polls show that many people think the attacks have gone too far, a point of view that has almost no voice in elite political and media circles. It's an example of the gap that exists not between the political parties, but between the public and the political class. While the partisan divide might be interesting, why not devote some space to that other divide, the one between the public and the politicians who are supposed to represent them?
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. In recent weeks, Counterspin has explored some of the problems of U.S. major media coverage of the ongoing violence in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, mainly the press's virtual wholesale adoption of the U.S.-allied Israeli government's presentation of the situation and its causes. With Lebanon, this has been marked by truncated timelines of the conflict that tend to start the clock with Hezbollah's lethal July 12th attack on Israeli soldiers inside Israel, omitting much very relevant history in the region. But besides media skewing of the picture of current events, there are myriad other pieces to this story that ought to concern us, including what lessons politicians in this country appear to be taking from it all, about international law, about which civilians matter, and about a U.S. president's ability to justify open-ended military action around the globe. Stephen Zunis is professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and author of the book Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. He joins us now by phone from Santa Cruz. Welcome back to Counterspin, Stephen Zunis.
My pleasure.
Well, I want to tip listeners to the piece that you did for Foreign Policy in Focus. It appeared also on Common Dreams, Congress and the Israeli Attack on Lebanon, a Critical Reading. That walks through the key provisions of this recent House resolution, because we can't cover all of that ground here. But I did want to start with international law. The House resolution states essentially that Israel is in compliance with relevant UN Security Council resolutions and Lebanon is not. Can you set up for listeners what resolutions are they talking about and how sound is their reasoning here?
The congressional resolution speaks of UN Security Council Resolution 1559 as calling for the disbandment of Hezbollah. In fact, the resolution only speaks of the disbanding and the disarmament of militias, which would include, of course, Hezbollah's militia. And so, indeed, in that aspect, Hezbollah is in violation of that UN Security Council resolution. But 1559 also calls for the withdrawal of all foreign forces from Lebanon. And given Israel's incursion into Lebanese territory starting last month, this would place Israel in violation of 1559 as well.
They also suggest that Hezbollah has been integrated into the Lebanese government. And I think for many people reading that, it does sound like an explanation or a justification for why Israel can attack Lebanon as a whole and not just Hezbollah.
Well, first of all, Hezbollah is much more than its armed wing. It is a legal political party, has a couple dozen seats in the Lebanese legislature, has a network of social service agencies, but it is still very much a minority party. In fact, its incorporation into the Lebanese government is simply that of having one of 24 cabinet seats, that of the Hydraulic and Energy Resources Ministry. So hardly a dominating presence by a terrorist organization, as Congress implies.
And for many partially or underinformed Americans, it sounds very much as though Hezbollah is running the show over there.
Hardly. The Lebanese government has tried to disarm Hezbollah, has been upset at their activities, but has been largely powerless to do anything to stop it. Nevertheless, it is the Lebanese government, the Lebanese people as a whole, that are getting the brunt of the Israeli attacks.
Well, many media talking heads are echoing the Bush administration line that Hezbollah is acting here really as a proxy for Iran or for Syria. But the House resolution doesn't raise that as a possibility. It states it as a fact and goes on to premise some pretty serious things on it. Can you talk to us about that?
The House resolution claimed that Iran had operational control over Hezbollah and that Syria and Iran could somehow halt Hezbollah's military activities, like turning off a spigot. In many ways, this parallels the exaggerated notions of Soviet and Cuban control of leftist movements and governments in Central America and Africa during the 1980s as a way of supporting the Reagan administration's broader geopolitical agenda. So what's particularly of concern about this exaggeration of the Syrian and Iranian role is that it may be paving the way to justify U.S. attacks against those countries in the name of the war on terrorism.
It is important also to note that if we are talking about identifying, as this resolution appeared to want to do, the people who are supporting the forces here, there are other countries that we might look to in terms of at least Hamas who are supporting these groups, right?
Certainly. The resolution claimed that Iran and Syria were the dominant supporters of the Hamas and Islamic Jihad groups in Palestine that had engaged in ongoing terrorist attacks against Israel. However, the bulk of their support has always come from Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Oman, other U.S.-backed dictatorships of the Arabian Peninsula. In other words, Congress seems to be intent on only targeting governments that the United States doesn't like, and not our sensible allies, who are at least as involved in supporting these radical groups as are Syria and Iran.
Who does support Hezbollah, and why do they support it within Lebanon?
The majority of its support comes from the Lebanese themselves. Hezbollah did not even exist until years after Israel began its occupation of southern Lebanon and its bombardment of Shiite civilian areas. This led to hundreds of thousands of poor Shiites streaming into the shanty towns of the southern Beirut suburbs, where they became easy picking to these reactionary clerics, which tried to provide them with some of these basic social services and helped steer their resentment against Israel and the United States into supporting their party and their agenda. Hezbollah is very much the outgrowth of reaction to the Israeli invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon, which lasted for 22 years, the U.S. intervention in the mid-1980s, as well as the neoliberal economic policies of the U.S.-backed government in Beirut, which has destroyed much of the traditional economy.
If there's one sort of trope that is omnipresent in U.S. coverage right at the moment, it's the one we heard, for example, from CNN's Paula Zahn after a report on August 1st about Lebanese civilian suffering, which it's not to say we're not seeing those images. We are seeing some of those images. But the report was followed up with Paula Zahn saying, quote, "And once again, we need to point out the Israelis say this war is not against the Lebanese people, but that when Hezbollah chooses to hide in the civilian population, these are the kinds of problems you end up with," close quote. What can you tell us about this idea of Hezbollah using civilians as shields and that?
First of all, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights have all pointed out that while it is legitimate to deliberately bring in your military activities into civilian areas, it is also illegitimate for governments to respond in ways which result in high civilian casualties. There are also quite a few incidents, if not the majority of incidents, where civilians have been killed by Israeli strikes. There is no Hezbollah activity anywhere close. Indeed, the most notorious incident of this war, the massacre of over 50 civilians in the village of Qana, according to the International Red Cross, there was absolutely no Hezbollah military activity anywhere close to the village, anywhere near the time of the attack, therefore directly challenging these Israeli claims.
I want to add that you contacted Congress members who supported this House resolution and found that on a number of these points that they declare so strongly and with such impact, they really couldn't provide any documentation, could they?
That is correct. Indeed, I even questioned them on the designation of Hezbollah as a terrorist group, asking them if they could name any incident in which Hezbollah had killed any Israeli civilians in the past decade prior to Israel launching its attacks against civilian targets in Lebanon, and they could not find any. Indeed, the Congressional Research Service, in its latest report, noted that Hezbollah had not engaged in any major terrorist attacks since 1994. And so the whole assumption that Hezbollah was an ongoing terrorist threat to Israel, the United States, or anywhere else seems to be greatly exaggerated.
What does that tell you about Congress members' level of information on this issue?
It is rather disappointing, and I think it's one reason we're in the mess that we're in Iraq and elsewhere.
We've been speaking with Stephen Zunes, author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. Find his recent work on Lebanon and the Gaza Strip at Foreign Policy in Focus online. That's FPIF.org. Thank you very much, Stephen Zunes.
Thank you.
If you are at all interested in how the media work, then you're interested in language. The words that are chosen or not chosen to describe a given policy or politician can go a long way toward explaining how people react to what they hear, see, or read. And a new book argues that it's not just our politics that have drifted to the right in America, so too has the language we use to talk about politics. Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at UC Berkeley. He's a regular commentator on NPR, and he's the author of the new book, Talk Walking Right, How Conservatives Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. It's available now from Public Affairs. Jeffrey Nunberg joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Counterspin.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Now, you write in the book, near the end, these are your words, the real sign of the right's co-option of the American political culture has been its ability to dominate that core vocabulary and make it the norm not just among its own circles, but in the larger American conversation about politics. You add that the media, even the allegedly liberal outlets, are among the right's most reliable allies in this endeavor. Tell us a little bit about how this happened and how one can spot this in the political discourse.
Well, it has to do not with the catchphrases and slogans that get everybody worked up, no child left behind, clear skies, healthy forest, and so on, but with what I call the ground-level language of American political discourse. These words like values and elite and liberal and bias and so forth. And what's remarkable is that when you look at the so-called liberal media, you find that these words are persistently used in a way that presupposes or favors the position of the right. The phrase liberal values is only a third as common as conservative values. Liberal elite is four or five times as common as conservative elite. Bias is used almost invariably to describe the liberal bias of the media, not the conservative bias of the media. And this in the media and in the conversations that people charge have a liberal bent. How did the right do it? They did it by repetition. They did it by cowing the media. They did it by better organization. They did it by telling a powerful narrative about this culture war in America that's really not based in any reality, but that has become part of the received wisdom of American politics.
One of the most conspicuous examples of this seemed to be that infamous 2004 exit poll, moral values was the most important determiner of voter preferences. And to the media, it seemed moral values meant something very specific, even though the question didn't imply that necessarily.
Right. In fact, that moral values answer got only, I think, 18 or 19% of the total response. So the poll was misleading in that sense. But the word values is a very good example of the process I'm talking about. The Democrats have been trying to reclaim the word since the early 1980s. Geraldine Ferraro talked about family values in her 1984 acceptance speech. Kerry made a celebration of American values, his theme for the 2004 campaign. Nonetheless, the word belongs to the right. And the reason it belongs to the right is it's become a kind of file header for this whole set of clips about lenient judges in Vermont, about the Ten Commandments monument, about kids in Texas who aren't allowed to wear red and green to school on Christmas, about a woman in England who wants to marry a dolphin, which is surely what will happen if gay marriage is permitted. All these stories that demonstrate this narrative about the good folks and ordinary people of America whose values and religious principles and patriotism and so forth have been betrayed by these supercilious, out-of-touch liberal elites of the coasts. And that's this powerful theme that the right keeps harping on, and it's enabled them to pull the center of the gravity of the language itself to the right.
And you wrote extensively in the book about the long-running effort to demonize the word liberal, a very successful effort. It would seem connected also in the book to this transformation, again, with an assist from the press, of the term elite. Tell us about that transformation of elite and what it means now.
There was a time when elite referred to people of particular power, influence, and wealth, and hence was associated with words like corporate, financial, business, and so forth. The way it still is in the British press, left, right, or center, even the Rupert Murdoch's London Times. In the American press, and again, I keep harping, this is the so-called liberal media, nowadays phrases like media elite, academic elite, Hollywood elite are far more common than phrases like business elite, corporate elite, and so on. And the phrase liberal elite is much more common than conservative elite. What this shows is that the word has been redefined to refer to a difference in lifestyle, a cultural difference, as is the function of all the language of the right, obscures the basic distinctions of power and influence that really keep the country going.
And as you write, the disappearance of class from all this. Instead, we're in this red state, blue state narrative. You point out some of the examples are kind of silly. David Brooks of the New York Times writing about how in red states the self is small, whatever that could possibly mean. But this is still the dominant way we understand these phenomena.
This is this story that basically by now comes with a system disc, that America is divided more than at any time since the Civil War. That's insane. I mean, it's insane in the sense that what we're really talking about is whether you prefer Lynyrd Skynyrd or Radiohead. That's the source of this big cultural division, whether you drive a Volvo or a Chevy Avalanche. And it turns out that even those distinctions aren't very important. It turns out, for example, that most Brie buyers are Republicans. Not surprising. It's sold in upscale neighborhoods where lots of Republicans live. Even so, it's been made by the right to stand in for this stereotype of liberals. It's soft, it's pale, it's runny, it's French.
Well, right-wing media critics have made noise over the years about labeling in the media. The media more often note when someone is a conservative than a liberal. This is somehow a sign of a type of media bias. Bernard Goldberg sold many books making this argument. What happened when you tried to test those ideas?
Yeah, Goldberg made this claim. He didn't ever count. He said he didn't want to sully his books with data, I guess. He said he didn't want to sound like social science. I did the counts, and it turned out that, in fact, the media actually label liberals as liberal more often than they label conservatives as conservative. Not by that much, and the total number of labels is not that great. I'm not going to make this particular instance evidence for conservative media bias. But the point is that this is just another one of these undocumented claims that gets out there. Everybody repeats. It's an afternoon's work to actually do the counts, and nobody bothers to do it.
Now, finally, a lot of this obviously happens in the popular media. You write a lot about the media in the book. There's also significant discussion in the book about what the left in general and maybe the Democrats in particular might try to do to change the language of politics. But if the media have adopted this kind of right-friendly template for discussing politics, how possible can it be for any of this to change?
Conservatives have managed to put their language over for several reasons. One is they've just been able to cow the media into using their words, into saying death tax rather than estate tax and so forth. But the other reason is that they've told a much more persuasive and compelling narrative than Democrats have, with occasional exceptions. Democrats have been timid about producing the kind of populist narrative that focuses on the true divisions in America. And the language is less important, the specific language is less important than that narrative. If you have the story, then the words will come out of it. You don't have to recapture values. That's only been a part of American political language for 25 years. It won't be part of American political language 25 years from now. It might be decency. It might be fairness. The important thing is that the language has to stand in for this narrative, and the Democrats have to make that narrative.
We've been speaking with Jeff Nunberg. He's the author of the new book, Talking Right. It's available now from Public Affairs. Jeff Nunberg, thanks for joining us here on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group, based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.